Good morning.
Good morning.
So at the end of today's talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about homework one. But before we're going to get started, I just want to talk about a little bit about, you know, where we've come and where we're going, right? I think we've came a pretty far way so far in this course. You know, we looked at GPU architecture, right? And we looked in pretty good detail at programming it with CUDA, you know, really focused on performance. And then we looked at a lot of parallel algorithms, sorting, searching, compaction. Now, Varun is going to kind of do somewhat of a capstone here where, in practice, you know, you guys wrote your own reduction, right, for homework two. In practice, you're never going to do that, right? You're going to use other people's code. You know, the guys at NVIDIA, I hate to say it, but actually I kind of love to say it, they know more about programming CUDA than I know. They know a lot more. They know a lot more about the hardware than I know. So when they release libraries that are really well optimized, we want to use them to build more interesting things. So today, Varun is going to talk about a number of tools and libraries that you can use to make programming in CUDA and programming the GPU easier, simpler, better. For your project, these are totally fair game. Like, if you're going to do something pretty high level in the GPU world, absolutely build on these tools. You know, you don't need to roll your own. Absolutely. And this will also help you a bit for homework three, where you're going to look at something called Thrust that we're going to talk more about. So then, starting next week, we're going to look at some graphics stuff as well as the student presentation. So a number of the student presentations are still kind of general purpose focused, so we'll have kind of a mesh of graphics and general purpose stuff moving forward, you know, for the rest of the semester. So with that, I'll give the floor to Varun.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick. So as you said, today we're just going to be talking about a lot of modern tools that you can use for computing on the GPU. And like Patrick said, ideally, a lot of these primitives, well, it's good that in this class you learn how to build them so that you understand how the GPU works. In practice, you're going to probably want to use as many different libraries as possible so you get the best performance and you get the best productivity out of it. So in this lecture, we're going to be looking at a lot of different things. First, we're going to start talking about CUDA and talk about different APIs and bindings that you could use for other languages as well. So hopefully this will be of nice use to you for your final projects or if you want to use CUDA for other projects. And then we'll wrap up with CUDA libraries and different debugging and profiling tools that you can use. And then we'll talk about some other GPU technologies, namely OpenCL and C++ AMP. One thing I wanted to start off with first was talking about CUDA documentation, because sometimes I get asked questions about different parameters and things like that. And yeah, that's perfectly fine, of course. But after this course or anytime you want to see the latest material or what changes with each toolchain, these are the different kinds of documents that you want to look at. So the C programming guide, for instance, is a huge summary of different performance optimizations you can do for the hardware, many of them that we've covered in this course so far, along with how to use the libraries and different things like that. The best practices guide is also a bunch of optimization tips. Like they have a chapter on getting rid of bank complex, for instance. And the reference manual is where you want to see the in-depth description of every function call in the CUDA APIs. And the occupancy calculator you've seen before in class, which is the Excel spreadsheet that you can use to see how many blocks or threads that you can fit on the device. Okay? So now I want to talk a little bit about CUDA, the organization of the CUDA system, and just as a background for what we're going to talk about today. So what you've been using so far in CUDA is what's known as the CUDA Runtime API. And the CUDA Runtime API enables these things like putting a kernel in the same file as your host code. So whenever you use that triple bracket syntax to launch a kernel, that's part of the Runtime API. The driver API is a lot more low level. And I've got an example in the next slide showing how these two compare. And so that's about the host code. When we talk about the device code, we have our kernels, but those kernels compile to what's called PTX, or parallel thread execution. And this is a kind of a virtual ISA, similar to assembly language. So this might be useful as we talk about things later to come. So anybody just want to shout out any differences they see between the runtime API example and driver API? They're both launching the same kernel, which is this naive copy kernel. You'll probably see in homework three. Anything worth mentioning?
Well, it's like you're doing a lot more stuff to like explicitly go through the steps and call the kernel as opposed to just having fancy
Exactly. So there's a lot of function calls. You want to create a context, then load a module into that context, get the kernel function from that module, and then launch the grid. And dot, 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 there's a few more lines too, because we want to use function calls to explicitly set each parameter for the kernel function that we're going to call. And so there's advantages and disadvantages to each approach. The runtime API is obviously a lot easier to use. There's a lot less function calls you have to manage. On the driver side, you might get better performance out of using this, but the odds of that are so slim, and especially the fact that your optimization efforts should probably be focused on the kernel code, not the code to launch the kernel. Okay. Another interesting thing I wanted to note is that you're loading the kernel from a file. Okay, so this is a .cu bin, so a CUDA binary. You could also load it from the PTX that I was talking about. And so the interesting thing about that is that the program is loaded at runtime, as opposed to when you're using the runtime API, you're using the NVIDIA compiler to compile your host and device code together. So that's going to be an interesting note as we move along. And this is very similar to what we're going to see with OpenCL, and also in the next few weeks when you talk about GLSL and shaders. So next we're going to talk about some language bindings. And one of the big reasons that we have this distinction between the runtime and the driver APIs is that because of the fact that you need the NVIDIA compiler to compile code with the runtime API, you know, when you have these triple backends, GCC can't exactly handle this. So to build off of that and build language bindings of your own, people are resorting to the driver API, which doesn't require a custom C compiler. You only need that NVIDIA compiler to compile your kernel code. But since you're loading that at runtime, you can use a regular compiler to compile the rest of your host code. Does that point make sense, everyone? So we're going to talk about a couple of different ways you can use GPU accelerated computing in the different languages. So we're spending a good chunk talking about PyCUDA, which has some interesting points to it. JCUDA, which I briefly mentioned, and I thought it would be interesting to some of you who are doing compute for robotics and other materials is how you can use GPU computing in MATLAB. Okay, so these are some slides from Andreas Klocker, who is the inventor of PyCUDA. And we're going to start with just a simple example of how you can use Python to write CUDA code. Has anyone here not seen Python or anything like that? Okay. So one point I want to note about Python is that it's an interpreted scripting language. So what we mean by that is that we don't have to compile the code before we execute it. Ideally, it gets executed just line by line. So that enables some optimizations, and we can see those. But another point about Python is that it's very easy to read, much more similar to English than C. So here, we're just initializing some random points, and then we're allocating memory on the GPU, and then we're doing a memcopy host to device, copying the data.
Okay.
Now, you can see that we're loading a kernel. So this is what I said before with the driver API, that our kernels are just, we're loading at runtime, so they're essentially just strings. Okay? So he's got this simple kernel that just multiplies every element by 2. And then we get that kernel, we call the function on it with our block configuration there, and then we copy the data back from device to host. Any questions about this example? Yes?
You load the kernel, the code from file?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, instead of the string, because I don't think it would be run all the code in the...
Yeah, I don't know exactly the PyCUDA API, but Python is very, very easy to just do a two-line snippet that'll just iterate over a file, concatenate it onto one giant string, and pass it in. So it can definitely do that at least. Okay. So some points about this is, like I said before, since Python is an interpreted language, we don't have the steps of compiling and linking for it. We just edit the code and we can just run it right away. So this is a kind of interesting question about how can not compiling enable some different things that we haven't been able to do before? When we just have our kernels as a string, for instance, what can we do that we couldn't do that we had if we had to compile them along with the rest of our code? Exactly. So it enables runtime code generation. So we can actually generate our kernels at runtime depending on what we need. And we can, in fact, so the guy who wrote this, Andreas, he actually has a paper on where they're exploring auto-tuning of kernels. So by seeing at runtime what kind of GPU you have and doing different calculations, you can try to, and heuristics, you can try to figure out the best kernel at runtime itself. So you don't have to do the performance tuning on your own. So as some of you might know, after Homework 3, performance tuning can be a bit of a pain, especially for the simple examples, or even for the Homework simple examples. Okay. So this is a really cool example that I saw. And can anybody explain to me what these top three lines do right here? There's a dot equals reduction kernel. Any ideas?
Does the reduction in the second order? As like?
Yeah, it is doing a parallel reduction.
Yeah.
Just at a high level, what is this code trying to calculate?
The sum of the array.
Not the sum of the array, but close. It's actually calculating a dot product. And okay. You see the syntax here, map and reduce, is just like we saw on Monday. So we're using the MapReduce paradigm to generate a kernel at runtime. So the map expression here, we're multiplying our two elements, and then the reduce expression, we're adding all those multiplications together, creating a dot product. So you can see how powerful an approach like this actually is. We didn't have to write any kernel code at all. So using just a reduction kernel class that's part of PyCuda, we have our kernel template there for us, and the actual expressions that we use are abstracted away, so we can change those. We're going to see a lot of different examples of this kind of mentality as we go through different computing tools. Any questions about this?
Can you give us a feel, if you have any idea, in terms of performance? Like, how does this perform compared to something that we would have written by hand?
That's a good question. I would imagine it would perform very similarly, because, especially with a reduction kernel as simple as it is,
mm-hmm.
Whether we're doing a reduction kernel where we're just adding the elements together, or we're doing something like dot product, the code doesn't really change.
Yeah, I agree in this case. I was curious if they had graphs where they showed numbers, but yeah, obviously it's very good.
Yes?
Don't you get a performance hit from just the fact that Python is... Well, so on the host side, do we get a performance hit from the fact that Python is just over...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so our host code is in Python. The PyCuda libraries are actually all C++ at the base, so at least we're getting the performance from that. But there is a Python layer on top, so we're going to get a slight performance hit in our host code. So it depends on your application whether really host code performance is a problem that you need to deal with. If really the majority of your time is going to be on your device code and that's what you want to optimize, these are definite options. And a lot of things we're going to talk about today, there's a trade-off between performance and productivity. So if you really wanted to, you could spend 2 months and write the very best reduction kernel you possibly could, but is that time better spent elsewhere in your application? So there's a lot of trade-offs associated with that, programmer productivity. Good question. Any other questions? Okay. I also want to talk about MATLAB. And so this is an example for computing a fast Fourier transform. And MATLAB, it's extremely simple to use GPU code. What do you have to do? You use GPU array instead of just a regular array function call to create an array on the GPU. The FFT function is overloaded, so if it takes a GPU array as an argument, it knows to do it on the GPU instead of the CPU, and then you gather to pull the data back. So very, very simple to just change your code from CPU to GPU in MATLAB. But are there any costs with an approach like this? How about as the amount of flexibility that you have as a programmer, especially when GPU code, you know how much performance you can get by just tuning it. That factor of 10x can go to a factor of 100x if you change the right parameters, right? So MATLAB doesn't really give you those parameters to change. You can change the block size and the grid size and different things like that with different options. But as far as the algorithms themselves go, they're black boxes. And on a previous slide, I talked about Accelerize, and they're a startup that has a library hook into MATLAB to enable faster GPU compute. And they were there before MATLAB's parallel computing toolbox. And when this came out, I'd imagine a lot of their business got taken away. But they often make the point to say that their code is faster than MATLAB's. If you're interested in this stuff, it's definitely something you can investigate. Any questions about this? Okay. Next up, we're going to talk about Tuple libraries. The majority of the time, I'm probably going to mention the last few in a couple of seconds, but we're going to be talking about Thrust. And Thrust is a very important library because it enables us to do a lot of GPU code without having to do all the overhead of setting it up and writing kernels. So before I go into Thrust, I wanted to go over templates. Has everybody seen templates before, or is there... So if you haven't, templates give us the ability to configure our code at compile time. So in this example here, this sum function here is completely generic. So it takes a type argument of t, and so we can do a sum for an integer and a sum for a float without writing a different function each time. And
does anyone notice anything about that sum? Not that I'm going to knock Vern's code here, but look at the declaration for sum. What do you guys think is odd or wrong about that? This is not a C++ class, probably. If you have anybody. Look at the arguments, A and B. Vern, what do you think? So if t, that could be any object, like Varun is saying. He's showing here intrinsic types, int, float, double, right, small values. T could be some giant object that I made. It could be an image, right? It could be a database. It could be anything. And right now that's being copied by value, right? So that function is copying this thing by value, right? So a lot of times when you see templates, you pass a reference. You do const t. But that's a total aside. Sorry, I just
want to
put you on the spot there.
Good point. Okay, and the last point I wanted to mention was the standard template library. So it's based on this concept of algorithms, iterators, and containers. So we use containers to hold our data, we use iterators to go over them, and we use different algorithms like sort or reduce to act on them. Okay, and we're going to see these paradigms again when we talk about Thrust. So Thrust is developed by two guys at NVIDIA Research. And the objectives here are primarily for programmer productivity and for generic programming. So if we have a function like reduce, let's try to use it as much as possible. Let's not keep rewriting reduce for every kind of data type that we want to do or different operations that we want to do. Okay? And there's also, they also do a lot of performance optimization. And we'll talk about how that's possible with Thrust. And it's a nice part is that it interoperates with CUDA C or C++, so you don't have to just exclusively use Thrust whenever developing your application. So let's look at a code example here. So what this code does is we're generating 16 million random numbers here. We're declaring, well, we have a host vector. So a vector is a class in the C++ standard library, template library, and we have an analog here of host vector, so a vector allocated on the host. We generate these 16 million numbers here with a random function. Then we copy that data from the hosted device because we've just overloaded the equals operator so that it doesn't memcopy. Then we can sort that data right here and then copy it back. Any questions about this example? Fairly easy to do sorting on the GPU now, isn't it? Yes?
So all the sort? No, it will run on device, not the host.
Because of the type arguments, so because you've passed in a dvec here, they do what they call static dispatch. So since they know that the type passed in was a device vector and not a host vector, it knows it needs to execute on the device. Any other questions? That's a very good point, though, because now if we pass the host vector instead, it would sort it on the host. So very easy to change your code to do this.
How come on the last line you can't say HVAC equals DVAC?
I was just wondering that myself. Maybe they just wanted to show the function, but I would think that would work. Okay, so talking about Rust is it's based exactly on these standard template library ideas, algorithms, iterators, and containers. And you're going to see a lot of analogs to the STL in Thrust. A nice part now is that with CUDA 4.0 and beyond, Thrust actually comes with the CUDA toolkit. So you don't have to install anything else to use it. You just have to include the Thrust headers. Thrust, the developers say, is based on four fundamental algorithms: foreach, reduce, scan, and sort. So the vast majority of things that you'll see are just built off of these four paradigms. So they make these as fast as possible and then keep reusing these over and over again to fit different applications. So we'll see some examples of this. One point I wanted to note that might be useful for your homework is Thrust and CUDA-C interoperability. So in this example here, if we want to use CUDA-C, then we have to get a raw pointer. We can't use Thrust vectors because CUDA memcopy is not going to take a Thrust vector. So we can use a device pointer cast function in Thrust to convert that into, or to convert a raw pointer here to a device, to a Thrust pointer that we can use, or we can do the other way around to convert it back. Any questions about this? Yeah.
How do you copy back?
Was it raw pointer? Copy
it?
Yeah, you just now, so it, okay, you just convert the pointer.
Mm-hmm. So we're creating a device pointer object that is that wraps the raw pointer. That's all. Any other questions? So another interesting side of Thrust is using Thrust with user-defined functions. So if you don't want to just do sort or just a simple parallel reduction, how can you do your own operations? So this is for computing Saxby, so it's just that AX plus Y is the function we want to use. One way you could do this is just writing a simple kernel that does this and executing the kernel. But perhaps a simpler way of doing things is creating a functor here for the operator, actually is to just do the Saxby operation, and then we can pass that into our transform function, which just iterates over it and then applies that return value to every element in the output array. So now we have the single transform that will apply whatever binary operation you want onto every element of the array. So now instead of writing your own kernels to do that every time, just write the simple operator, pass it to transform, and let it do the iteration and configuration of the kernel. Any questions about this?
So can anyone tell us why the operator there has both host and device qualifiers? Right, so this will run on both the host or on the device, right?
And I guess another question to follow up on that, why wouldn't you just use global instead? You see the global operator in front of your kernels. And of course, you can call your kernels from host code. So why do you not use global? Exactly. So now if we use host and device, then we can have a return type for our function. OK. So now onto the performance of Thrust. So a question that you could have is, with making everything so generic, does performance suffer? And Thrust goes a long way to try to address this. So one nice part about using templates is that since they're evaluated at compile time, we could inline, for instance, that Saxby function that we saw before, so we don't have the overhead. And we can also do type analysis to improve the performance of various routines. So here they have an example of two fill kernels. Fill just meaning copy a single element into, or copy a single number into all elements in an array. Okay? And these numbers might be hard to read, but let's consider just this example of this 8800 GTS. And we can see the performance for a character data type fill being far worse on the naive operation than, say, a long or an integer. So any ideas as to why that is? We're seeing a factor of 35 in performance difference for just doing a fill of character instead of a fill of integers.
Maybe the implementation does with the same number of numbers in the item.
so let's assume here that the input arguments are the same. So we're copying a million items either way. So we're copying a million characters or a million integers. Any ideas? So this goes back to global memory coalescing. So the global memory can only be accessed in groups of 64 or 128 bytes, different things like that. So when you access elements from the same group, then, or from that same segment, then those accesses become non-coalesced. So you have to do multiple instructions to do all those reads. So you can see the performance drop heavily because of this lack of coalescing. What Thrust does is it does a type analysis at compile time, realizes that it's doing fill for chars instead of ints, and thus combines all those operations together and does the write. So because now those accesses are coalesced, we get the same full throughput for characters and integers. So this is an example of how doing type analysis can actually get the best performance with Thrust. And you can also see this kind of thing in your homework whenever you're doing sorts. Any questions about this? Although, for a different reason than coalescing. Okay, so Thrust has a lot of different cool features. Kernel fusion, another one is going over arrays, instruction structures of arrays. I have slides on these and we can talk about them if we have time at the end of the lecture, but they're a bit time consuming, so I'll skip over them now. So that marks in talking about Thrust for now. Any questions about Thrust overall? As you can see, it's a tool that you want to heavily leverage if you're writing GPU code for our different applications. If you can realize that your application can be broken down into these simple things like reduce, scan, sort, then you can just use Thrust primitives to get you the best performance. Okay. If you're doing other specialized things, there's a lot of high performance libraries available to you. So if you're doing linear algebra, there's kubelas, or fast Fourier transforms, there's cuffed. And if you're doing image or signal processing, you have NVIDIA native performance primitives. There's a lot of also other GPU accelerated libraries, many of them even higher level than these, which are pretty low level libraries. But there's a very large ecosystem for CUDA, so a lot of these things are available to you. So if you're planning on doing any CUDA work for your final project, definitely can look into these libraries. Okay, now we're going to talk about different tools that you can use for profiling and debugging your CUDA. So those tools are named Visual Profiler, Parallel Insight, and CUDA GDB. So Visual Profiler is a graphical profiling application. So all we mean by profiling is that we can use a variety of different counters, performance counters that are on the hardware itself, and we can see the different kinds of what different instructions are doing when we're executing our kernels. So a bunch of these counters can collect data on global memory throughput, instructions per cycle, active warps, register counts, bank conflicts. Practically all the things that we've discussed in this class, we can get data on and analyze. And Visual Profiler will actually make recommendations to you based off of that data. So I think I have an example of that next. So text is a bit hard to read here, but this is an analysis that Visual Profiler has done of a Tesla card running matrix multiply. So it says here that this kernel is likely compute bound because the achieved instructions per byte ratio is greater than the bounds. So it does a lot of different calculations and can give hints on where your kernel is bound, whether it be on compute or on memory. Down here is an example of the different performance counter data it gets, like active warps that are running on that particular shader module, and there's a bunch of other ones that I mentioned. If you want to see the full list, the Visual Profiler user guide has a nice table of all the different performance counters and what they actually mean for your application. And also, it does pretty charts too. So, any questions about Visual Profiler? So, this tool is available for Windows, Mac, and Linux. So, definitely something you can use to see where the performance is going when you're writing your CUDA kernels. Next up is Parallel Insight. And before I actually want to talk about this, a couple of you had emailed me when you're doing your homework one and you asked, why isn't it working whenever I try to do a breakpoint in Visual Studio to examine my CUDA code? So why is that the case?
Well, so imagine that you imagine that you're running Kubernetes and you were able to call your GPU. What happens to your graphics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your screen lives there.
No, we,
that's my guess.
Can you say that again?
I mean, actually, we were running our code on several GPU cores. So if we break a port, we set a breakpoint in the code, and we can pick the result from all that cores.
Exactly. So that's a very good point. So when we say a breakpoint where? So we have multiple warps and multiple blocks executing the code at different points. Where exactly are we breakpointing at? So that's one thing. And another thing is, like Carl said, the GPU is being used for a lot of different applications. What happens when we stop it? And probably Visual Studio doesn't even know that this code is running on a different device, right? So how's it going to breakpoint on a different device altogether? It doesn't know about these things. It's just executing MVCC to compile our code and launch it for us. What do you know? So Parallel Insight is that magical tool, codenamed Nexus. So what it does is we can debug and profile CUDA, OpenCL, and even Direct3D shaders, so if you're writing graphics code, all integrated into Visual Studio. So like Carl mentioned, the caveat is that you need an extra GPU. So you need one GPU to display your system and another one so that it can actually debug the code that's running on. And one nice thing is that it in fact supports NVIDIA Optimus. And when I say extra GPU, I should clarify, that doesn't mean extra NVIDIA GPU, that's just anything that has a display output. Does anybody know what NVIDIA Optimus is?
Is it the thing where
exactly. So Optimus is a very cool software platform where if you have an integrated graphics, like Intel integrated on your computer, and you also have an NVIDIA discrete GPU, the NVIDIA driver will determine whether your workload is best suited with integrated graphics or your discrete GPU, and use whichever one it feels appropriate. And that would be, and that will also be seamlessly, so you don't notice the transition. So that way you get the best battery life if you're just browsing the internet and you don't need a discrete GPU. Or if you're playing a game, then you can use your or running CUDA, you can use your discrete GPU. And since you do have two GPUs on your system, you can now do parallel insight work on your laptop itself. So a lot of the newer laptops with discrete GPUs, or discrete NVIDIA GPUs, have Optimus technology. Any questions? So here's a very busy screenshot of Parallel Insight. So we can see here, on this side, we actually have CUDA watching us one particular warp, and we can see what the different register values are for each warp, for each thread in the warp. Over here, we can see the call stack for the functions that we've called so far. We can see the local variables available to us. We can see the disassembled code, and we can see the progress of different warps and blocks in our code. So Parallel Insight is a very powerful tool. If you do have two GPUs, it's a very nice thing to use. And if you don't have Windows or Visual Studio, you can use CUDA GDP, which is arguably not as pretty, but you can achieve very, very similar results. So the interface is exactly like GDB, and you can monitor individual warps, see disassembly, and debug your code from there. And this is available for Mac and Linux platforms. Okay, so that's wrapping up for talking about profilers and debugger tools. Any questions about that for CUDA?
So what I want to mention here is that GPU compute tools have come a long way. I mean, 5 years ago, we barely had anything. Well, we were able to run CUDA on the CPU under simulation and put in a breakpoint. But they've really matured here. I think CUDA has a pretty good set of tools, especially compared to what you see out there in OpenCL. Now, when we start looking at OpenGL, WebGL, OpenGL, ES, GLSL, we're going to see that some of the tools are not as good as we see here with CUDA. Like, one thing Rune mentioned is that Parallel Insight can do debugging for Direct3D. But he didn't say anything about OpenGL, and I've been asking these NVIDIA guys, every cigarette, I mean, they know who I am, I've always come up with that. When are we going to get GLS out of the bugging? And it's apparently coming, but we won't have it this semester. So so actually now I'm getting ideas for projects. We may actually have interesting class projects on doing tools. Doing a tool for a class project, completely fair game. But we'll see more about that. We'll talk about, especially on the graphics side, the bugging strategies to kind of work around some of the lack of tools that we have right now.
And also, if for debugging your applications for homework or other things and you don't have debugger tools available, remember that printf is always there for you. So if you want to see data at different points, most GPUs don't allow printfing on the device, so memcopy it back, print it, see what it is. Okay. Next, going into the land of OpenCL. So OpenCL is the Open Compute Language, and it was initially developed by Apple, and we saw the first implementation in macOS 10.6 in Snow Leopard. And they developed it with help from AMD, IBM, Intel, and NVIDIA. And now they passed that specification on once they're complete to the Kronos Group. And the Kronos Group is the same organization. It's an industry consortium that also manages OpenGL and GLSL and a lot of things with the open prefix in front of it. So this is a slide from the OpenCL overview. And the idea that they have here is that with this intersection of CPUs and GPUs, we need some common runtime to do a lot of parallel computing. And that's where they feel OpenCL fits in that gap. So it's a parallel framework, but it's not just for GPUs. It's also for CPUs. If you heard from FPGAs, it could even work for them too. I don't know if that stuff is out yet. And if there are more kinds of devices that come along the way, perhaps OpenCL can run on them too. And as far as different runtimes we can actually use today, we have the AMD Accelerated Parallel Processing SDK, and that works on AMD CPUs, GPUs, and their APUs, the Fusion chips. Intel has an SDK for running on their Intel CPUs, and that will also soon probably be for their integrated GPUs whenever the next line after Sandy Bridge comes out. And we also have the NVIDIA OpenCL runtime for NVIDIA GPUs. So now we have compute code that actually runs on more things than NVIDIA GPUs. Something very important to keep in mind. So here's some very small OpenCL host code. Could anybody determine what those four lines at the top are for? Setting the work size, global and local. Do they look familiar at all? Ideas? Exactly. It's the exact same thing. So threads per block, blocks per grid. I recognize this kind of load program source kind of syntax. OpenGL, yeah, that's definitely a valid answer. We saw 40 minutes ago, too. So with the CUDA driver API, we had the exact same thing. So we're loading our code from some external file, compiling it at runtime, and using it. Okay, so OpenCL doesn't have an equivalent of the CUDA runtime API, where we can put our kernel and our host code in the same file and have some compiler process both. OpenCL is always like this. So we have some external kernel file, we compile that at runtime, and then we configure that. And then the kernel launch is this function called nq ndrange kernel. So ndrange is the equivalent of a grid. And so we're queuing up that kernel for execution. Right. Any questions about this OpenCL host code? The important thing here is not to see the syntax. I think any one of you can see OpenCL and immediately figure out how to do with it based off your CUDA experience. You can see that too from the device code. So this seems similar to any other kind of code you've seen before. There are very few differences between this and an equivalent CUDA kernel. So instead of doing thread IDX times block dim plus block IDX, block dim times block IDX plus thread IDX, we just have a get global ID function. And we can do that for either dimension and the X and Y for our grid. And this is just a simple copy kernel. That line of code would be the same if you wrote it in CUDA. Okay. So as I said, OpenCL is extremely similar to the CUDA driver API, and the kernel code is also eerily similar to CUDA C. So if you know CUDA, you can start working in OpenCL very quickly. And if you do want some very a guide on syntactical differences, there are some things that OpenCL can do that CUDA can't do and vice versa. NVIDIA has a jumpstart guide that will tell you exactly what those differences are. I should note also that OpenCL is a C-based API. So all of the host code is C, and there are C++ wrappers available, an official one. And there's also PyOpenCL, like we saw PyCUDA, that does the exact same thing. So now we're going to get into a more discussion-based kind of setup, and we're going to talk about what should you use, OpenCL or CUDA, for your application. And I have a few slides on this, but I wanted to ask you first what were your opinions on what you would use if you were developing an application.
Well, if you want to reach as many people as possible, you can use OpenCL to support non-integrated scripts.
Okay.
That means that if you, I guess since OpenCL is so cross-platform, it's very difficult to tune for the specific, it's very difficult to tune for any specific target device, whereas with CUDA, you have a relatively small subset of target devices that you could even, that it's even possible to run it on, and so if you already specifically know what your target device is, it's easier to do.
That's a good point. Now, if you know exactly that I'm going to be using a GTX 480 to run all of my code and nothing else, you could probably get the exact same performance from an OpenCL or a CUDA implementation. Both of them will get compiled to the same PTX that gets sent to them. Well, not the same PTX because they have different compilers, but it'll be the same PTX code that'll be running on the chip. So theoretically, they should be the exact same performance. But as Carl said, if we have a lot of different kinds of CPUs or GPUs that we could be running this code on, it's going to be difficult to tune. Do we want, for instance, the same kernel to be running on our CPU as on our GPU? Yeah, probably not. Parallel reduction that spans to 10,000 threads is not going to work very well on your CPU. There are better ways of doing things. So there's that compromise too. And then we'll even see, perhaps later in the course, that when tuning for AMD GPUs versus NVIDIA GPUs, there's a lot of different design that you can work with, or different performance aspects to consider at the very least. So when we talk about OpenCL versus CUDA, one thing to note is at least compatibility. So CUDA, if you just stick to it, only runs on NVIDIA GPUs. For a variety of different reasons, that's not necessarily true. I think we're going to have one student presentation on the topic. But for the most part, we can say that. OpenCL, on the other hand, is an industry consortium supported by a lot of different guys. So we have GPU vendors here, CPU vendors here, FPGA vendors here, guys who make networking chips. A lot of people support OpenCL. So it can potentially run on a lot of different devices. So that's a win, at least on the OpenCL camp.
Actually, Rumer, if you could flip back to that slide for a second. Tell me, you know, say we're in a startup or in a company, and we're trying to figure out what technology to adopt here, CUDA or OpenCL. And one thing that we care about is getting the latest hardware features as soon as possible, right? Who do you think can move faster here, OpenCL or CUDA?
CUDA.
Right, so NVIDIA controls CUDA, right, and that's a plus and a minus, but NVIDIA, you know, when a hardware feature is ready, you know, CUDA's going to expose that immediately, right? Whereas with OpenCL, you know, there's all of these vendors, they all have representatives that meet in this group and they discuss, and then they bring features in. I mean, they're still pretty fast at doing it, but NVIDIA definitely has an edge in this case, and also a disadvantage in that now you're very dependent on that one company or NVIDIA as opposed to the standard. So there's certainly pluses and minuses here. At my work, we used OpenCL quite a bit for some stuff. However, though, I can't say that necessarily was that's not the silver bullet. Like, I can't say you should always use OpenCL, you should always use CUDA.
So Patrick gives a very good point. So whenever you whenever people have to talk to discuss things, things get slower. And you can not just see this in OpenCL, but for example, in the browser wars of the 90s versus today, or a development of HTML now, you have a bunch of people talking together to try and bring things forward, as opposed to just browser vendors just throwing whatever features they want. So there's compromise in either way. We'll discuss that a little bit later. So one point we should make is, doesn't everyone just want an NVIDIA GPU to run their code anyways? Why would we want something else? And this is a graph from actually my final project last year for this course. And I was doing performance comparisons between AMD and NVIDIA GPUs. And I won't say the performance measurements were perfect. There was a lot of flaws in my study, but...
he says this now after I graded it.
That's the important thing. That there's always a chance, like in this case, for instance, where an AMD GPU can perform a lot faster than NVIDIA one, because the hardware is organized differently, and we can exploit that for different workloads. So we might talk about that later in the semester, but we don't always want an NVIDIA GPU for our application. It's possible that other vendors can deliver better performance for per dollar or for other metrics.
And this is a compute bound.
Yes, this is a compute bound workload. This is a Black-Scholes, which is a computational finance calculation, calculating options pricing. Okay, and this is also from that, and this is just comparing performance on just the same NVIDIA GPU between OpenCL and CUDA. These numbers are probably not valid anymore because now CUDA 4.1 actually brought the LLVM compiler toolchain to both CUDA and OpenCL. Already had that LLVM-based toolchain. So there's a new compiler with CUDA, so these numbers can change. But in one case, we see CUDA and OpenCL perform almost identically, and in another case, we see that OpenCL actually performs better than CUDA in the example. So here, we're just really benchmarking compilers. But the idea still is there that performance-wise, OpenCL and CUDA, there's a toss-up with that as well. Now, another point we can make is programming frameworks. So when we talk about CUDA 4.0, there's a lot of advancements that NVIDIA brought for GPU computing, like a unified address space that Tim mentioned on Monday. We can actually do things like new and delete, and even do virtual functions on the GPU itself. And GPU Direct, which is also something he mentioned on Monday, where now if we have a multi-GPU system, they can transfer data between each other without going all the way to the CPU and back, so saving bandwidth. These features are not available to OpenCL. And if you see the past releases, right now we're on OpenCL 1.2. There's an 18-month period between releases of OpenCL. And as Patrick said before, NVIDIA moves a lot faster than that. So when new features come out, like for instance, there are new optimizations that you can make with Fermi, those features are CUDA only because they involve function calls that are only in CUDA. OpenCL just can't have a function call for Fermi cards. Could NVIDIA publish extensions to OpenCL? Maybe. But there's a difference in terms of the frameworks. Any questions about this? The last point I wanted to make was libraries and mind sharing. So CUDA, because it's much older, came out in 2007 or 2006, I believe, has a much larger ecosystem. So there's a lot of libraries, including, you can see on the link that I posted earlier about GPU accelerated libraries that you can use for your CUDA application. That library account is simply not available for OpenCL as well. In particular, there's Thrust. So you saw how easy it is to make GPU code run with Thrust. You can figure out the exact computation you want, break it down into the Thrust primitives, and just use those, minimizing the amount of kernel code or configuration that you actually have to do on your own. So this is a big boost to productivity. OpenCL, you still have to write your kernels. Granted, there is stuff like PyOpenCL that lets you use different runtime type runtime code generation to generate kernels for that. But the question is open, though, whether OpenCL will catch up. So there are other ways where OpenCL is moving that CUDA is not. So we have embedded profiles for OpenCL. So imagine OpenCL running on your smartphone. The GPUs on the iPhone 4S and iPad, for instance, are OpenCL. At the hardware level, OpenCL compatible, although Apple hasn't released libraries for those. And we also have WebCL too. So imagine being able to run GPU compute in your browser. So, well, for better or for worse, I'm not sure what people will do with that, but cool things maybe. So where these two frameworks are going is can also affect your decision as well. Is there any other points that people think of that you should keep in mind whenever you're developing CUDA or OpenCL, making the choice between the two?
For your projects, any of these are fair game. I mean, I know you guys are a lot more familiar with CUDA, right? But when Rude did his project last year, he used OpenCL. You know, we had basically one lecture or half a lecture on it, and it's pretty easy to get started with. So either one is okay with me. And then this WebCL standard, which is very up and coming, that, if you want to do something really bleeding edge, that would be very cool to do, especially if you're going to combine that with WebGL. I will warn you, though, if you're going to try to do, say, you know, say, you were doing like flocking in WebCL and you wanted to render it in WebGL. Those WebCL and WebGL, they can't communicate with each other yet, which means that you'll have to bring data from WebCL back to system memory and then back into WebGL. Whereas with OpenCL and CUDA, we have really good interop with OpenGL for to combine compute and rendering. But it's very, you know, you'd be on the bleeding edge if you're using WebCL. I don't even think, it's not even an official standard right now. There's still, but there is an implementation that's available. So.
Oh, anything else? Okay. The last framework that I want to touch upon was C++ AMP. And this was unveiled back in, by Microsoft in just June of last year. And AMP stands for Accelerated Massive Parallelism. So the idea that they're doing here is that they're targeting what they call heterogeneous computing, where we're not computing on all the same kind of device, but there's a lot of different devices that our code can run on. We have multi-core CPUs and GPUs, of course, but they also want to target something like infrastructure as a service. So cloud computing, where your memory isn't always on the same device, you're using a large cluster of CPUs. So there are some nice pictures showing where code is going with that. So we can picture this space as how the processors differ in terms of compute and how the memory architecture differs for versus cloud versus CPU versus GPU. So on your simplest CPUs, your memory is unified, for instance, whereas we get farther away to multiprocessor systems, then memory is tied to specific processors, so you have to do different bus communication. You have incoherent memory for GPUs, so not everything always is updated. Then we have memory across different systems altogether for cloud computing. On the processor side, you have your out-of-order processors that'll give you a lot of performance improvements, all the way to something like GPUs, where you have a specialized instruction set that can only do certain things. And that specialized can even go all the way to the GPU days before CUDA, where you could only use graphics, for instance. So software is moving different ways. If you're using C++, for instance, you're writing code for systems with unified memory architectures and out-of-order CPUs. Multi-core CPUs, you have to start worrying about memory spreading across. Cloud systems, you have to worry about how your memory is organized. And for some cloud systems where you're even putting GPUs in the cloud, then you have to start worrying about ISAs as well. And GPU, you have to worry about memory, although that is getting better with caches, but then you're dealing with specialized ISAs as well. So a lot of different things to consider when you're talking about coding for different parallel architectures. C++ AMP attempts to cross over everything. So the code snippet I have here is for a matrix multiply in AMP. And this code could actually run on the CPU, the GPU, or I guess even the cloud. So there's a few points I wanted to make. The first is this class called an ArrayView. And an ArrayView is an abstraction of how to actually access the data. You can think of it as an iterator range. So it's not the container for the data itself, but an abstraction that you can use to access the data, and the runtime will take care of where to do the actual data loads and stores itself. So if this data was on the GPU, for instance, and you're executing this code, and whenever you wrote to the array view, it would realize ahead of time first that you need to copy this data to the GPU. You're running this computation on the GPU, so you're editing on GPU memory. And then when you access on the hosted memory again, it's going to pull it back for you. Similarly, if you're doing it on a cloud system or whatever, you're using some kind of APIs to push that data. the next point we wanted to make was this use of lambda expressions, which are a feature of C++11, I believe. So they're using a function, a parallel for each, which is similar to the for each we saw in Thrust, but we're using a lambda expression so that we can pass in the code that we want to apply to each element. And the last thing I wanted to mention was this restrict. So restrict is actually the only keyword addition that C++ AMP does to change C++ to support this architecture. Everything else is done with just classes or a lambda function. So what restrict does is it limits the instructions that can be used within the body of the lambda itself. So for instance, on typical GPUs, not Fermi for instance, we can't use recursion. So when we call restrict direct3d, what we're saying is that make sure the code in here works on systems that support direct3d, in other words, GPUs. So the compiler will check for you that, okay, you're doing recursion, that's an illegal operation because that's not supported by all direct3d GPUs.
Yep. Who's pushing this technology, Microsoft?
Microsoft.
That's the direct3d.
Mm-hmm. Other than that though, it's fairly straightforward. We have this parallel for each, so we're operating over each element of our output array. And we can see that with this index here, which is a 2D index. And in here, all we're doing is calculating the dot product. So we're looping all the elements, getting the A and the B element, multiplying them, adding up to the sum, and storing the sum in our output element for C. So just doing the dot product of the row and the column to do the matrix multiply. So this code can run on the CPU or the GPU, just depending on where these vectors are. These A and B vectors are.
Now, if this were to run on the GPU, I mean, would this just use global memory all the time? Like, how would this know when to use shared memory?
Yeah. Exactly. So this one would use global memory. They talked about other classes they introduced called tiles, and that's their abstraction for using shared memory. And the way they set those up is that tiles can only be used inside a restrict direct3D. So that way, they don't want you using tiles for CPU code, but only for the GPU code. All right, any other questions about this? So this I thought was a really cool slide of how they're using the different features they introduced across these different boundaries. So it's the same graph we saw before. We're using ArrayView, we're abstracting over how this memory is organized. So your data accesses should work whether the memory is on different machines or it's on a unified memory architecture. And with restrict, we're overcoming the boundary of what instructions does the processor we're running on support. So whether we're using GPUs that only have a limited instruction set versus a CPU that can do much more. The restricted enables this to cross over. So as I said before, the only new keyword that is added to C++ is that restrict. Everything else is implemented with functions and classes. So that restrict can be implemented by other compilers since Microsoft said they released as an open specification. And this is, I guess, bleeding edge because there's no implementation out yet and the open spec was released 2 weeks ago. And we're going to see the first support for this in Visual Studio 11, which I guess is shipping at around the same time as Windows 8.
So this is for our projects, this is probably not gonna have the right timing. But for your research, this will have your, depending on how long your research takes, this will be have good timing for you.
And who knows, this may be available in the Windows 8 beta or something like that. That I don't know. But at least Visual Studio 11 will probably have betas coming soon too, so you might be able to use all these features. And nice of the part is that you don't need parallel insight to actually debug this. So debugging and profiling for C++ AMP is included with Visual Studio. So debug across CPU, GPU, and even cloud. So I guess we're running a little early. The last point I wanted to make was this is a slide that I thought was actually kind of amusing. And this was also part of Herb Sutter, who's the C++ architect at Microsoft and the guy who gave this talk on C++ AMP introducing it. And the slide that they have here. Granted, he gave his talk at the AMD Fusion Developer Summit, so all about AMD stuff. You can see the slide here. So in the early days,
with these graphics and proprietary driver APIs like CUDA, where we're tied to a single GPU and a single architecture. Now, in more modern days, we're using things like OpenCL and Direct Compute, which is a Direct3D animal, which is part of DirectX for compute, where our APIs transcend device boundaries, so we can use different kinds of devices, not the same, not from the same binary. And now the future is frameworks like this, where the code doesn't have to live only on the GPU. We can write the same code that runs anywhere. So trying to bring the free lunch back in some sense, where programmers don't have to worry about the devices they're running on. So any thoughts on this slide? So I guess the concluding point to make is that this stuff is moving very, very quickly. So 2012, for instance, is going to be a very big year for GPUs. We're going to see new we already see new versions from AMD. We're going to see the newest chips from NVIDIA. We're going to see Intel have an OpenCL supporting GPU. And every year, we're going to see improvements like this. So it's very tough to stay on top of things, but if you are on top of things, you can get a lot of improvements for your code and other things.
I'm not fully convinced by some of the stuff in the architecture, because the idea of we're just gonna go back to when you write code that isn't really to work at all very well.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they don't want something to do it. It doesn't seem like a good idea.
Yeah. And the question to wonder is, what are people going to do with this? If you're a scientific computing guy, perhaps you just want to stick with CUDA because you want to pull out every inch of performance that you can get. But is there a market for GPU compute for consumer applications where you don't need the 100x performance, you can live with 20x? It's good enough for your consumer. Is that okay? What applications can GPU compute enable for consumer technologies? So can we see, we don't see applications that you can buy at the store that are CUDA compatible, for instance. That's not there right now. Is there a market for stuff like that? Can GPUs improve things?
Well, actually, recently I saw, I think it's Sony, it's one of Sony's video editing tools, and they have OpenCL integration. Which is, so like anything that requires video or maybe audio analysis and like cutting up.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Like Photoshop, I think CS5, for instance, yeah, some of the calls are GPU accelerated for different blurs and things like that.
Beyond like the design and artistic applications, I don't see too many.
Mm-hmm. So over the summer, I was reading some articles by AMD PR, for instance, and they're really selling that GPU compute is, and heterogeneous compute is going to be the next big thing. It's going to change the way consumer applications work and things like that. Maybe. Yeah. And I made it the retort that if GPU compute is the next big thing, why don't we see these kinds of libraries and ecosystem for OpenCL, which is the only thing they support, as opposed to CUDA. So we'll see if they're going to live up to that or not. That is my last slide. Since we have some time left, I could cover some of those advanced features of Thrust.
So one point I want to make about this last slide we're looking at is you also have to look at who's telling you the information, right? When you have Microsoft telling you something versus AMD versus NVIDIA, right? You can't take everything as ground truth, right? Certainly people are going to spin it to what is in their best advantage. I think moving forward, you know, this idea of heterogeneous computing, we're definitely going to see improvements here, but some algorithms have a certain kind of workload where sometimes you have a data parallel algorithm, right, like reduction for matrix multiply, and that wants to run on a GPU type architecture. We have a lot of threads, and the threads are three. But then you have a lot of things that are just test parallel. We have a lot more complicated computation where it's not completely, where each item can't just be have the same structure on a different set of data. So having an architecture like C++ Ampere will at least allow us to do one type of technology to have workloads that are distributed accordingly, but it's not going to take like our CPU work, CPU type workloads and magically make them run faster than GPU. I really don't, not soon. So, but we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what this course is like 5 years. You know, what we say 5 years from now.
Yeah, that's really a good point. That at the underlying thing, we still have to learn parallel algorithms. We can't just say toolchain parallelize our software for us. Of course, people are trying to do that, but for now, parallel algorithms are a very important thing, and your code has to be parallel to be able to exploit these things. Moving back to Thrust, some of the advanced topics that are there is this idea of kernel fusion. So this code here is computing the length of a vector, the norm, in a couple of different ways. One is they call the slow path here, and what we're doing is we're applying our square operator here, which is square is the number. What we're going to do is apply that square to every element in our device vector, and then apply reduce on that. So we've squared every element, do the parallel sum reduction to sum all the squares together, and then do the square root of that. And that'll get us one norm. What are the performance problems with something like that? So think about memory accesses. Not in terms of quality, but maybe in terms of quantity. So when we have something like this, we're executing two kernels. So we're doing one kernel for the square. So we have to load and store. We have to load every element, square it, and store it. And then after that, we have to load every element, do the parallel reduction, store it, and do our reduction tree, whatever. So we're doing a lot more reads and writes. What we can do instead is what Thrust calls kernel fusion. So we can do things with what are called transform iterators, or in this example, a transform reduce function. So this transform reduce call here does everything in one call. So we give it our beginning and end points. We give it the square function operator over each thing. We get an initial value for the output, and then also give the reduction operation. So we do the squares and reductions all in one function call. And Thrust will combine everything for us. So that we say.
Behind the scenes, is Thrust like dynamically building a new kernel?
Yeah, you could say that. The reduce kernel is already there for us, because Thrust is a reduce primitive. So using templates, we're putting the operations that we want executed within the reduce there for us. So it's all built off of templates.
Templates are compile time in C++.
Yeah, so there's no performance overhead with that as well, which is nice.
There's a whole field called template metaprogramming. Has anyone explored that?
It was a section of C++.
So, not that I want to get too off topic here, but template metaprogramming is that you can use a compiler to write functions for you that are executed at compile time. So, for example, say you have factorial, you know, and I want to do what's 8 factorial, or this 8 times 7 times 6 times 5. You can write template functions that call themselves such that that is evaluated at compile time, and when you call factorial 8 or factorial 12, the compiler figured that out, and really just a constant. So it's a whole, you know, these hardcore C++ guys that push template metaprogramming to like a whole other level. So if you just Google it, there's entire books on the topic.
Okay. And there's one other example I wanted to give. And this is for structures of arrays and arrays of structs. And let's go over arrays of structs first. So whenever we're considering, say, a vertex, for instance, we can map that as a struct, right? We have a struct with an X, Y, and Z coordinate. So a flow 3, for instance, is a struct. If we want to have a bunch of coordinates, we can put all the structs into an array. The big problem with that, though, is say we want to run our CUDA kernel on an array of structs. I talked earlier about memory coalescing rules, and that we can only do accesses with 64-byte or 32-byte limits or whatever. If we use float threes and are pulling them one by one with our kernels, we're going to end up with uncoalesced memory accesses. So the performance is going to drop significantly because float threes don't divide evenly into our memory access structure. individual floats do, but when we have to pull float threes one at a time, the memory accesses are going to come uncoalesced. And then, so, but since floats themselves can allow for coalesced access, since they're multiples of 4 bytes instead of 12 bytes, then if we have an array, or a structure of arrays, then we can achieve coalesced accesses. So what we have is one struct with 3 arrays. We have an X array, which is all of the X coordinates in one array, all of the Y coordinates in one array, and all of the Z coordinates in one array. So does that concept make sense? The idea of arrays of structs, structs of arrays, struct of arrays. Any questions about that? So, of course, then we want to have the performance of using struct of arrays, but without the complexity of using that. We still want to be able to access our data as vertices, because that's the easy way of putting things into Thrust, and that way we don't have to rework our logic. So Thrust has these handy things called zip iterators. And what a zip iterator does is it allows us to group our arrays as tuples. So we keep our host data, or our host code, organized as struct of arrays. So we have 3 arrays here for the X coordinate, the Y coordinate, and the Z coordinate. We use the zip iterator to make a tuple out of the X, Y, and Z. So we have this tuple organization here. We can then run transform on all these tuples. So we've done a tuple for the input for our three different inputs here. And then we're going to call our rotate function with that. So then our operator here is going to take the tuples and then break them down into the X, Y, and Z coordinates, do them that way, and then return a tuple. And that tuple will then be stored in the struct of arrays format. So we still get the programming advantages for simplicity of arrays of structs, but with the performance of structure of arrays. Tricky example, but might be useful to you. And there are other very cool iterators that you can use too to achieve performance while still using Thrust primitives. So minimize the amount of kernel code and configuration that you have to write, and use the built-ins of Thrust app to achieve better performance. Any other last questions?
Okay, so I want to talk a bit about the homework, but first let's thank the room. So homework 3 went out. Has everyone logged in? You guys all make sure you're logged in to work? If you haven't, please do so, right? So you have 2 weeks to do homework 3, and the sooner you make sure your login works, the better off you're going to be. If you wait till the night before it's due and there's an issue, you're going to have to use your bonus days, you know? So make sure that you guys get on that early and often.